guess I should confess that I am starting to get up. The latest music fads are passing by. Hello there. This is Rish Outfield, and you're listening to the Rish Outcast. I'm sitting out on the back porch at the cabin. I was reading a book and enjoying the sunshine on me. And there's this remarkable phenomenon that occurs here where you can hear the wind blowing up the side of the mountain, and then 10 seconds, 20 seconds later, the wind reaches here and you feel it. It makes just this rushing sound through all the trees. Then it gets here and it blows and it's super loud here, but it's not something that I have experienced other places. The wind blows and you feel it. So I thought I would turn this thing on and bring it out here. And if the wind happens to blow to interrupt this podcast, so be it. If not, I'll probably get a sunburn. The reason I turned this thing on is the story that I just finished reading is from Stephen King's latest anthology. No, it's not an anthology. Story collection, If It Bleeds. I think it's from last year, 2020. And the first story in the book was called Mr. Harrigan's Phone. It's a solid story. It's right up there. And it's good that the man can still craft a yarn as well as he did when he was in his 20s. Mr. Harrigan's Phone is about a boy who gets hired by an old rich man to read to him. He goes up to this guy's mansion and he reads to him and he befriends Mr. Harrigan. There's the wind, can you hear it? They live in a small town that's sort of isolated. Similar, I guess, to where I grew up, except the roads aren't paved, so I guess it's even more rural than where I grew up. And the old man, upon retiring, had bought a big house, or had a house built out in the middle of nowhere, so he wouldn't be bothered. Anyway, they strike up a friendship, and for his birthday, the boy gets an iPhone, one of the first iPhones, an iPhone 1, and he shows it to Mr. Harrigan, and Harrigan, you know, has no time for these newfangled. There it is. Sometimes the wind will blow so hard, I look at these dead trees. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, right where I'm looking. They're all dead and they're still standing, and I wonder, why are you still standing if the wind blows this hard? And eventually they do fall over. I've just never seen one fall over. My brother will chainsaw some of them that are close enough to the house that he worries, to the cabin rather, that he worries that they might fall onto the cabin. There was one just right here. I'm looking at the stump, and the ground started to erode around the bottom of this tree. And I was worried about it. And so I asked my brother if he would chop it down because it's close enough and it's on an angle. So the only place that it could fall would be against the house. Cabin, sorry. And we cut it off, and now it's just a 2-foot stump. And the ground has continued to erode around its base. And I would say by this time, 3 months from now or 6 months from now, its roots will be out. It won't have a base at all. And I guess this time next year, we'll probably have to remove it, or it will fall out on its own. I don't know how these things work, but the edge of the hill right out beyond the deck here has been eroding constantly and remarkably fast. Maybe that's a symbol for us all. Anyhow, in this story, the boy comes into some money. Mr. Harrigan gives him some money, and he decides to spend it on an iPhone for Mr. Harrigan because he had been like a big magnate. He reads the Wall Street Journal. He had been a big businessman, and on an iPhone you can look at real-time stocks. And this guy, the old man, despite saying that, you know, he has no need for a phone, and the things we own end up owning us, all of this stuff. He takes right to it. The boy shows him how to do certain things, and he loves it, and he becomes addicted to it, just like any of us with our cell phones, with our smartphones. And then he dies. And Craig, the boy, decides to bury the phone with Mr. Harrigan. Harrigan leaves him a bunch of money in a trust, and the boy calls the phone to thank Mr. Harrigan, and he imagines it ringing down in the cemetery in the coffin, and he gets a text from Mr. Harrigan. And the boy goes to his dad and says, you know, he was buried alive. We have to dig him up. We have to go. And the dad explains how autopsies work and embalming works, and that there is no chance that Harrigan is alive. The dad says, well, maybe, you know, somebody is pranking you, et cetera, et cetera. The reason I tell you this story isn't so that you go out and read this thing by Stephen King, although that would be nice. I don't imagine he needs my help. Although I have no idea if his sales are as strong as they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago, certainly not what they were 30 years ago, 40 years ago. The reason I mention it is because about 200 episodes ago of the Rish Outcast, I ran my story subtext. In my memory, it was the first Rish Outcast episode. It was one that I did in the car, presented this story, and it was one that Big Anklevich always liked. And I liked it too, even though I never felt like it quite reached its potential. And if you recall that story, there was a lot of similarity there. Texts that came from beyond the grave with somebody who was buried with their cell phone. And the first couple of times that stuff like this happened to me, I anguished. I felt so bad when I discovered that something I had written was similar to something somebody else had written, or in the case of the Orson Scott Card book, chillingly close, unsettlingly close, disturbingly close, exactly the same title. Anyway, let me talk a tiny bit more about Stephen King's story. Craig goes to middle school, which I would have called junior high, and he gets beat up by a bully, and he calls Mr. Harrigan's phone and tells Mr. Harrigan about it on his voicemail, and he gets a text back. And the bully that beat him up commits suicide. I guess there's a little bit more to it than that. Craig is able to convince himself that it's coincidence, or maybe it isn't. That maybe there are ghosts, maybe Mr. Harrigan, who had a famous temper and a desire to see justice done, maybe he was reaching out from beyond the grave. And that's pretty much the whole story. There are other incidents that happen as the years go by. And even though there's no chance Mr. Harrigan's phone still has a charge or the account is still active, Craig can still call that number when he needs to. And that reminded me of the story I wrote called My Friend of Misery, where somebody has a supernatural ally that can make trouble for the people who cross them or hurt them. Once again, I don't feel bad that my story and Stephen King's story has this in common. It's just how the world works, and we're all influenced by certain things that maybe put the same idea in my head that put in your head, and we take them in wildly different directions or only slightly different directions. In the case of Orson Scott Card and me, the different directions weren't that wild. I was really surprised that he wrote this book where there were child abductions and sex trafficking going on. And one day maybe I will write a sequel to My Friend of Misery that continues the story from where it left off in what I wrote. I don't have an answer on that. It happens so much that I feel like, okay, it's just something that you have to accept. Shakespeare said, there's nothing new under the sun. And that was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. There was a trailer I saw for a movie with Hugh Jackman and Rebecca Ferguson in it the other day, and I thought, well, I've seen this movie. I've totally seen this movie. And it wasn't a movie so much as it was a story by Robert Sheckley called The Store of Worlds that was run on the Drabblecast. That was where I first heard it, and I loved it. I thought it was the greatest thing that he has ever run on there. Now, granted, I haven't heard all of the Drabblecasts anymore, but I remember writing him an email telling him just how much I loved it, and I listened to it again a couple of years later, and it was better the second time. There was an episode of The New Twilight Zone where you could go to a pawn shop and pawn your memories. They had some device that could take your memory away, and you didn't have the memory of your first kiss or your high school graduation. And there would be rich people that would buy these memories so they could live vicariously and experience these things. And anyway, the Hugh Jackman movie is very similar to all that, but it doesn't mean that it's a ripoff, or it doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile. I rented a movie last week called Freaks, and it's not the Todd Browning 1932 Freaks. It's 21st century, a much more recent movie about a little girl that has powers, and her father keeps her locked away for fear that the outside world will find out what she can do. And it's a world where there are freaks out there. There are people that have these abilities, and they're all hunted and rounded up, and I think probably experimented on. And it had so much in common with Stephen King's Firestarter, a book that he wrote in about 83, 82. I didn't feel like it was a ripoff of Firestarter, but I bet that the filmmakers had read that book and said, man, that made such an impact on me. I want to write something like that. And there's nothing wrong with that. I feel like there are people that can take it too far. When I was reading Christopher Paolini's Aragon, I felt so much resentment and anger about that. But it's because the Star Wars trilogy is sacred to me. And it's not like this little thing that only I have read, like The Store of Worlds. It's the Star Wars trilogy. And when I read Armada by the writer of Ready Player One, and it's the same premise as Last Starfighter, that bugged me. And then when I got to the part where one of the characters said, oh, this is just like that old movie, The Last Starfighter, I couldn't get past that. I was done. I never finished the book. So everybody has their own sensitivity about how close you can hew to something that has come before. And I've no doubt on this earth, not even 1%, that if we sat down with that writer, he would say, no, I wasn't even at all influenced by The Last Starfighter. I've never heard of The Last Starfighter. My editor put in that line about The Last Starfighter just to cover my butt. I absolutely guarantee you that that's what he would say. Because I'm cynical. In my old age, you can't help but grow cynical. On the Doonstief, we would do the Broken Mirror story events. And I wish that we still did those because they were very enjoyable. Where multiple people could write a story based on a specific premise, and the stories would go in any number of directions. And there were really excellent stories that came out of them, and I feel proud that I could have helped midwife those into existence. We all have our own abilities and our own talents, and as creative people, there are things that I will never be able to do as well as you. And there are probably a couple of things that I do fine that you really struggle with. Not every story that I write is good. I finished a story today. I wrote The End about an hour before I sat down here to finish my book, or the story rather. And I'm not sure if it's any good, but I'm just going to go on to the next one, and maybe it will be good. You just got to keep going despite whatever stumbling blocks hit you. Here comes the wind again. There you go, it hit me now. Ooh. I imagine it's really loud on the microphone. This might play hell with the editing. But I figured it wouldn't take a lot of editing to do this. It was just sit down and talk for a few minutes, and then I'm going to play something from last week from my drive home, just so you have a full episode. And I like it. If you are a creative person in whatever creative way you have, know that whatever you worked on most recently is not perfect and will never be perfect. And it's more important that you go on to the next piece and work on it and keep producing than try to perfect something that you have already created. That's my opinion, and it could totally be wrong. If it's a novel and you see where it's not perfect, maybe you should go through and write another draft or fix this part and, oh, here's a plot hole, let me fill that in and make it better. But again, it's never going to be perfect. If you're a creative person, then you're lucky in a way. You've got the capacity to improve the world, to add beauty to the world, to add variation to the world. And the world is better with you in it. I recommend that you go out and buy My Friend of Misery. It is not perfect. Or go way back and listen to that episode on subtext. And it's not perfect either. But these are things that I worked on, and I'm proud of them. And now it's time for me to shut this off and go in and maybe start on some new project. Or if I were smart, finish a project that has stalled halfway through. I appreciate you listening to me and sitting out here on the deck, the sun beating down, the wind blowing past. You can always support me on Patreon. I really appreciate anybody that just donates a dollar, or if you have more than a dollar and you want to... It's not really donating. It's, I guess it's a tip jar in a way, but you're getting something for what you pay. You get exclusive content that other people don't get, and you help me feel the motivation to create more. I wish you well. And I hope that wherever you are, you can feel the wind on your face and that it is refreshing and fine and good. Farewell. So, hey guys, this is Rich Outfield. I just left the cabin. The sun will be going down in the next, well, it's still an hour off. I don't like to leave when it's dark, because there are so many deer around, and I had that incident last year where there was an elk in the road. It wasn't just crossing the road, it was already standing in the road. And they're harder to see in the twilight, and of course, at night. So I've tried to make a goal for myself this year to always leave while it's still light. We got another one of those little trips where I didn't want to leave when it came time to leave. I remember 2 years ago, I guess, is when I first started doing this. Maybe not. Maybe it's been 3 years now when I come down here by myself. But it was 2 years ago, 2019, when I was really into it and started doing it every week or so. And I missed a couple weeks when I was having problems with my computer. But last year, 2020, the plague year, I came up every single week, I think but one, because nobody was traveling, nobody was doing anything. The world was on hold. And so it was very easy to come up here, and I enjoyed it. But today I didn't want to leave. I still have plenty of food. I brought enough for a week, probably. It just seems like a smart idea. Just bring enough for a week and leave it here. And next week I'll eat some of it. And the week after that, maybe I'll bring some more. But I always will have more. And I think the very first time I came last year was around the time when my cousin's wife wouldn't let me come over to visit him because of the pandemic. You know, we weren't getting together. In fact, I think that there was a stretch of
5 weeks or something like that, when you were just supposed to interact with people with whom you cohabitate, and that was it. And that already feels so alien, like, oh, that was something that I dreamt or I saw in a movie. But I remember there being a time that I came last year and I had brought a bunch of sodas for myself just because I was going to be coming week to week. And my brother-in-law had brought my nephews to go fishing there, and they had drank all of my soda. And so I had intended to stay 2 days, but midway through the second day, my head hurt so much from not having a soda that I cut the trip short and, you know, drove to civilization, went to a gas station and filled up. It seems unlikely that that will happen now, because I took several last week and hid them around the cabin so that I'll have access to them just in case that sort of thing happens again, even if they were to drink all of my soda, which they're kids, they do that. I should have an emergency stash. So I didn't particularly want to leave today. I was sitting at the table in that chair, and I could see deer outside the window. They're just hanging out at the next cabin over. They've got a deck that's open and shady, and so the deer will go there and they'll just sit in the shade. There were several, and one of them was a fawn. I just thought it was kind of remarkable that I was sitting there. I didn't have to go look for them. I could just turn my head and I could see these deer. And most people don't have that. You probably don't have that, right? Anyhow, I just wanted to tell this brief story and then I'll let you go your way. But my brother has 3 traps that he sets at the cabin. Well, I guess there are 4 traps. There are 2 very small traps and 2 large traps. And when he knows he's going to be coming in a few days, he will set the traps, put, you know, a little piece of bread or something like that in the traps. And they're not like bear trap, snap shut kind of things. They are wire box type traps where there's a trigger inside the trap, and when an animal steps on the trigger, the back of the trap closes, and so they're stuck in there. And that is useful if it's like we originally had these traps at my dad's farm, and when I would go there to mow lawns, I would stumble across animals in these traps, and sometimes they were just cats, like wild cats, and I would let them go. I think we had chipmunks in there every once in a while, and we got skunks in there a lot of times. Every once in a while we would get a raccoon in there, and the traps were all sprung, which I thought meant, you know, he had not set them, but that wasn't the case. So last time I was here, just a week ago, we had caught a woodchuck in one, and I felt bad for it. It's a rodent, and it's a fairly cute little animal. And all you have to do is just leave them in there, and they'll die. If you drag the trap out to where the sun will get it, they'll die very fast. But I felt bad for it, and so I decided I would let it go. I was going to take it for a drive to where it wouldn't be able to come back to the cabin. It would just run free in the woods somewhere. But I didn't end up doing that. I ended up taking a walk and carrying the trap with me. And so I did, and it dropped out and it headed for the hills. And it probably, you know, will be fine. But this time, I was going out, and I was going to go for a walk. I can hear the frogs when I go up on the top deck, but not when I'm down on the ground, which is strange, but I think it's just the trees block the sound. And if you get up high enough, you can hear the frogs because they're actually quite far away. But I was going to go look for the frogs, just, you know, listen to it, take some pictures, that kind of stuff. And I heard this sound, and it was an animal making a noise, like a high-pitched, almost like a bark or a squeak. Squeak, there's that's the word that you're looking for. And it sounded to me like this was some kind of attention-getting sound. Like, you know, maybe it's mating season or something like that. And so I went around the side of the cabin, and I saw a fairly large woodchuck on the stairs. And my brother has put these two big boards where he cut little slices in the boards where the handrails go that you can slide right there at the very bottom of the stairs and at the very top of the stairs to prevent these animals from going up on the deck, because when we come back from winter break, the deck's always covered in poop from these animals. And I don't know why they go up there, because there's no food. I've been there 3 times this year already. And all 3 times that I've been here, I've swept the poop off the deck. And my brother thinks that the two boards are all that it takes to prevent them from getting up. But I saw, no, it is going up the stairs. And so I got my phone out to record the animal doing this. It's not to prove my brother wrong, but when I talked to him yesterday about seeing a woodchuck do this, not a woodchuck, like a potgut do this, he didn't believe it. But what happened was it went out on the outside of the staircase and went up the railing that way, like an acrobat or something, like a gymnast could do. So I got the camera, I turned it on, and I tried to record it going up there, and then something large moved in the wood pile. And when I say large, these little animals make a noise, and it can be startling to hear noises, but you can always tell that it's something small. And this was the sound of something large. And the yipping sound, the squeaking, was still happening, but it wasn't coming from this potgut. And what happened is the potgut scrambled over the deck, and then it ran all the way to the other end of the deck, and it leapt off and just fell, 20 feet onto the ground. And then just kept going. And I'm surprised that it didn't get hurt. But these animals are hardier than we are. Their bodies are meant to leap and I don't know.
I don't know.
But I was just like, why would it go that nuts trying to get away from me? And then I saw a shifting in the shadows under the deck in the wood pile. And this large bear-like head came out and it looked at me. And I knew what it was. It was a badger, but it was so large, so big, bigger than any of these rodents that we see around these parts. And I was surprised. And anyhow, it stuck its head out and it looked at me, and I tried to get it on camera, but it was hard to tell because of the shadows where it was. And I did end up getting a couple of angles of it, but just its head was sticking out. It was in the shadow. Its body had gone under the logs when it saw me. And I didn't exactly see how big it was. But judging by how big the head was, this is a considerable animal. The badger looked at me for a second or five, and then it stuck its head back under the logs and it was gone. And I kept hearing the yipping. Not yipping. I don't know why I keep saying yipping. The squeaking sound. And it turned out that there was a woodchuck, but like a great big woodchuck. At first I thought it was a porcupine. It was so big. In my brother's largest trap. And this noise that it was making was a sound of being afraid. And what it was afraid of was the badger. And I remember, was it 2 years ago, we had a trap that we had set up and it had something in it. And when we came a couple of days later, the trap had moved. Something had dragged the trap, you know, like 15 feet away from where it had been. And so now my brother always puts something heavy on each of the traps. But, you know, we assumed that it had been a raccoon or something trying to get to the animal that was inside the trap. But this thing was definitely big enough it could have moved a trap. I feel like it was probably too big to fit inside a trap. But I don't know.
I don't know.
Anyhow, so I did go around and I tried to get a photograph of the animal in the trap. And as I got closer to the woodpile, I could hear growling coming from under the logs. And it was a low growl, but it sounded like a dog. It sounded like the growls that you're used to when a dog is like, "Do not come close to me." And I found that it accomplished exactly what a growl is supposed to do. I was just like, you know, I don't need to get very close to this trap. I don't need to take a picture of this animal. Let's go for a walk. But it also made me think later of what if I had heard that growling when I was trying to sleep or before I had seen the badger. What would I have thought it was? And would that have been terrifying? I don't really have an answer. It's kind of a rhetorical question. But I'm seeing deer on the side of the road. I probably should hang this up and concentrate on driving. Just because, I mean, the sun is still 20 minutes from setting. But that means it'll be full dark by the time I get home. You never know. So I'm going to leave you with this. Hopefully I can find a place for this in an episode. And I will talk to you soon. Goodbye. Oh, hey guys. Here I am yet again. This is the third recording session of four for this episode. I edited it together and I was going to put it out as my next episode and it was still too short. And so I thought, well, I'm going to find something to make it longer. I will find a story or a sketch or a poem or something to add on here to pad out the runtime. And I'm putting this here at the very end with a warning. So what I decided to do was share with you The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And I warn you right now, I'm going to play it, and then I'll give you the explanation as to why I am sharing it with you. But if you're operating heavy equipment or you're driving, I'm going to ask you to turn this off now. Because, oh, I bit off more than I could chew with The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. I'm just worried that it's going to put everybody to sleep. But I wanted to give you something extra. This comes from love, kids. It's good to be loved, right? But you can love somebody too much. So be warned, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner is from 1798. That was when it was first published. It is wordy, it is long,
bits are a bit obscure, and it is narrated by me. So I think that's more than three strikes. But thanks for listening, as always. And there you go.
The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three. By thy long gray beard and glittering eye, now wherefore stoppest thou me? The bridegroom's doors are opened wide, and I am next of kin. The guests are met, the feast is set, mayest hear the merry din. He holds with him his skinny hand. There was a ship, quoth he. Hold off, unhand me, graybeard loon. Eftsoons his hand dropped he. He holds him with his glittering eye. The wedding guest stood still and listens like a 3 years child. The mariner hath his will. The wedding guest sat on a stone. He cannot choose but hear. And thus spake on that ancient man, the bright-eyed mariner. The ship was cheered, the harbor cleared, merrily did we drop. Below the kirk, below the hill, below the lighthouse top. The sun came up upon the left, out of the sea came he, and he shone bright, and on the right went down into the sea. Higher and higher every day, till over the mast at noon, the wedding guest here beat his breast, for he heard the loud bassoon. The bride hath paced into the hall, red as a rose is she, nodding their heads before her goes the merry minstrelsy. The wedding guest, he beat his breast, yet he cannot choose but hear, and thus spake on that ancient man, the bright-eyed mariner. And now the storm blast came, and he was tyrannous and strong. He struck with his o'ertaking wings and chased south along, with sloping masts and dripping prow, as who pursued with yell and blow, still treads the shadow of his foe, and forward bends his head. The ship drove fast, loud roared the blast, and southward aye we fled. And now there came both mist and snow, and it grew wondrous cold, and ice, mast high, came floating by, as green as emerald. And through the drifts, the snowy clifts, did send a dismal sheen, nor shapes of men nor beasts we ken, the ice was all between. The ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around. It cracked and growled and roared and howled, like noises in a swound. At length did cross an albatross, and through the fog it came, as if it had been a Christian soul, we hailed it in God's name. It ate the food it ne'er had eat, and round it flew. The ice did split with a thunder fit, the helmsman steered us through. And a good south wind sprung up behind, the albatross did follow, and every day, for food or play, came to the mariner's hollow. In mist or cloud, on mast or shroud, it perched for vespers nine, whiles all the night, through fog smoke white, glimmered the white moonshine. God save thee, ancient mariner, from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why lookest thou so? With my crossbow I shot the albatross. The sun now rose upon the right. Out of the sea came he, still hid in mist, and on the left went down into the sea. And the good south wind still blew behind, but no sweet bird did follow, nor any day for food or play came to the mariner's hollow. And I had done a hellish thing, and it would work 'em woe, for all averred I had killed the bird that made the breeze to blow. Ah, wretch, said they, the bird to slay that made the breeze to blow. Nor dim nor red, like God's own head, the glorious sun uprist. Then all averred I had killed the bird that brought the fog and mist. 'Twas right, said they, such birds to slay that bring the fog and mist. The fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrow followed free. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. Down dropped the breeze, the sails dropped down. 'Twas sad as sad could be, and we did speak only to break the silence of the sea. All in a hot and copper sky, the bloody sun at noon, right up above the mast did stand, no bigger than the moon. Day after day, day after day, we stuck, nor breath nor motion, as idle as a painted ship upon the painted ocean. Water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. The very deep did rot, O Christ, that ever this should be. Yea, slimy things did crawl with legs upon the slimy sea. About, about, in reel and rout, the death fires danced at night. The water, like a witch's oils, burnt green and blue and white. And some in dreams assured were of the spirit that plagued us so. 9 fathom deep he had followed us from the land of mist and snow. And every tongue, through utter drought, was withered at the root. We could not speak, no more than if we had been choked with soot. Ah, well a day, what evil looks had I from old and young! Instead of the cross, the albatross about my neck was hung. There passed a weary time. Each throat was parched and glazed each eye. A weary time, a weary time, how glazed each weary eye! When looking westward, I beheld a something in the sky. At first it seemed a little speck, and then it seemed a mist. It moved and moved, and took at last a certain shape, I wist. A speck, a mist, a shape, I wist, and still it neared and neared, as if it dodged a water sprite. It plunged and tacked and veered. With throats unslaked, with black lips baked, we could not laugh nor wail. Through utter drought, all dumb we stood. I bit my arm, I sucked the blood. I cried, a sail, a sail. With throats unslaked, with black lips baked, agape they heard me crawl. Damn it, agape they heard me call. Gramercy they for joy did grin, and all at once their breath drew in, as they were drinking all. See, see, I cried, she tacks no more, hither to work us weal. Without a breeze, without a tide, she steadies with upright keel. The western wave was all aflame, the day was well nigh done. Almost upon the western wave rested the broad, bright sun, when that strange shape drove suddenly betwixt us and the sun. And straight the sun was flecked with bars. Heaven's mother, send us grace! As if through a dungeon grate he peered, with broad and burning face. Alas, thought I, and my heart beat loud, how fast she nears and nears, are those her sails that glance in the sun like restless gossameres. Are those her ribs through which the sun did peer as through a grate? And is that woman, all her crew? Is that a death? Are there two? Is death that woman's mate? Her lips were red, her looks were free, her locks were yellow as gold. Her skin was as white as leprosy. The nightmare life in death was she, who thicks man's blood with cold. The naked hulk alongside came, and the twain were casting dice. The game is done. I've won, I've won, quoth she, and whistles thrice. The sun's rim dips, the stars rush out. At one stride comes the dark. with far-heard whisper o'er the sea, offshot the spectre bark. We listened and looked sideways up, fear at my heart as at a cup. My life-blood seemed to sip. The stars were dim, and thick the night. The steersman's face by his lamp gleamed white. From the sails the dew did drip, till clomb above the eastern bar the horned moon with one bright star within the nether tip. One after one, by the star-dogged moon, too quick for groan or sigh, each turned his face with a ghastly pang and cursed me with his eye. 40 living men, and I heard nor sigh nor groan. With heavy thump, a lifeless lump, they dropped down one by one. The souls did from their bodies fly, they flew to bliss or woe, and every soul it passed me by, like the whiz of my crossbow. I fear thee, ancient mariner, I fear thy skinny hand, and thou art long and lank and brown, as is the ribbed sea sand. I fear thee and thy glittering eye, and thy skinny hand so brown. Fear not, thou wedding guest, this body dropped not down. Alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide, wide sea, and never a saint took pity on my soul in agony. The many men, so beautiful, and they all dead did lie, and 1,000 slimy things lived on, and so did I. I looked upon the rotting sea, and drew my eyes away. I looked upon the rotting deck, and there the dead men lay. I looked to heaven and tried to pray, but or ever a prayer had gushed, a wicked whisper came and made my heart as dry as dust. I closed my lids and kept them close, and the balls like pulses beat, for the sky and the sea and the sea and the sky lay like a load on my weary eye, and the dead were at my feet. The cold sweat melted from their limbs, nor rot nor reek did they. The look with which they looked on me had never passed away. An orphan's curse would drag to hell a spirit from on high, but oh, more horrible than that is a curse in a dead man's eye. 7 days, 7 nights I saw that curse, and yet I could not die. The moving moon went up the sky, and nowhere did abide. Softly she was going up, and a star or two beside. Her beams bemocked the sultry main, like April hoarfrost spread, and where the ship's huge shadow lay, the charmed water burnt alway, a single and awful red. Beyond the shadow of the ship I watched the water snakes. They moved in tracks of shining white, and when they reared, the elfish light fell off in hoary flakes. Within the shadow of the ship I watched their rich attire, blue, glossy green, and velvet black. They coiled and swam, and every track was a flash of golden fire. O happy living things, no tongue their beauty might declare. A spring of love gushed from my heart, and I blessed them unaware. Sure my kind saint took pity on me, and I blessed them unaware. The selfsame moment I could pray, and from my neck so free, the albatross fell off and sank like lead into the sea. O sleep, it is a gentle thing, beloved from pole to pole, to Mary Queen the praise be given. She sent the gentle sleep from heaven that slid into my soul. The silly buckets on the deck that had so long remained, I dreamt that they were filled with dew, and when I awoke it rained. My lips were wet, my throat was cold, my garments all were dank. Sure I had drunken in my dreams, and still my body drank. I moved and could not feel my limbs, I was so light almost. I thought that I had died in sleep, and was a blessed ghost. A and soon I heard a roaring wind. It did not come anear, but with its sound it shook the sails that were so thin and sere. The upper air burst into life, and 100 fire flags sheen. To and fro they were hurried about, and to and fro and in and out, the wan stars danced between. And the coming wind did roar more loud, and the sails did sigh like sedge, and the rain poured down from one black cloud, the moon was at its edge. The thick black cloud was cleft, and still the moon was at its side. Like waters shot from some high crag, the lightning fell with never a jag, a river steep and wide. The loud wind never reached the ship, yet now the ship moved on. Beneath the lightning and the moon, the dead men gave a groan. They groaned, they stirred, they all uprose, nor spake nor moved their eyes. It had been strange, even in a dream, to have seen those dead men rise. The helmsman steered, the ship moved on, yet never a breeze up blew. The mariners all again worked the ropes, where they were wont to do. They raised their limbs like lifeless tools. We were a ghastly crew. The body of my brother's son stood by me knee to knee. The body and I pulled at one rope, but he said not to me.
I fear thee, ancient mariner.
Be calm, thou wedding guest. 'Twas not those souls that fled in pain, which to their courses came again, but a troop of spirits blessed. For when it dawned, they dropped their arms and clustered round the mast. Sweet sounds rose slowly through their mouths and from their bodies passed. Around, around flew each sweet sound, then darted to the sun. Slowly the sounds came back again, now mixed, now one by one. Sometimes a dropping from the sky, I heard the skylark sing. Sometimes all little birds that are, how they seem to fill the sea and air with their sweet jargoning. And now 'twas like all instruments, now like a lonely flute, and now it is an angel's song that makes the heavens mute. It ceased, yet still the sails made on a pleasant noise till noon, a noise like of a hidden brook in the leafy month of June, that to the sleeping woods all night singeth a quiet tune. Till noon we quietly sailed on, yet never a breeze did breathe. Slowly and smoothly went the ship, moved onward from beneath. Under the keel 9 fathom deep, from the land of mist and snow, the spirit slid, and it was he that made the ship to go. The sails at noon left off their tune, and the ship stood still also. The sun, right above the mast, had fixed her to the ocean, but in a minute she again stir, with a short, uneasy motion, backwards and forwards half her length, with a short, uneasy motion. Then like a pawing horse let go, she made a sudden bound. It flung the blood into my head, and I fell down in a swound. How long in that same fit I lay, I have not to declare. But ere my living life returned, I heard and in my soul discerned 2 voices in the air. "Is it he?" quoth one. "Is this the man?" By him who died on cross, with his cruel bow he laid full low the harmless albatross. The spirit who bideth by himself in the land of mist and snow, he loved the bird that loved the man who shot him with his bow. The other was a softer voice, as soft as honey dew, quoth he, "The man hath penance done, and penance more will do." But tell me, speak again, thy soft response renewing. What makes that ship drive on so fast? What is the ocean doing?
Still as a slave before his lord, the ocean hath no blast. His great bright eye most silently up to the moon is cast. For he may know which way to go, for she guides him smooth or grim. See, brother, see how graciously she looketh down on him.
But why drives on that ship so fast, without or wave or wind?
The air is cut away before, and closes from behind. Fly, brother, fly, more high, or we shall be belated. For slow and slow that ship will go when the mariner's trance is abated.
I woke, and we were sailing on, as in a gentle weather. 'Twas night, calm night, the moon was high, the dead men stood together. All stood together on the deck, for a charnel dungeon fitter.
All fixed on me their stony eyes, and in the moon did glitter.
The pang, the curse, with which they died, had never passed away. I could not draw my eyes from theirs, nor turn them up to pray. And now this spell was snapped. Once more I viewed the ocean green, and looked far forth, yet little saw of what else had been seen.
Like one that on a lonesome road doth walk in fear and dread, and having once turned round, walks on, and turns no more his head, because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him tread.
But soon there breathed a wind on me, nor sound nor motion made. Its path was not upon the sea, in ripple or in shade. It raised my hair, it fanned my cheek, like a meadow gale of spring. It mingled strangely with my fears, yet it felt like a welcoming. Swiftly, swiftly flew the ship, yet she sailed softly too. Sweetly, sweetly blew the breeze, on me alone it blew.
Oh, dream of joy, is this indeed the lighthouse top I see? Is this the hill? Is this the kirk? Is this mine own country? We drifted o'er the harbor bar, and I with sobs did pray, oh, let me be awake, my God, or let me sleep alway.
The harbor bay was clear as glass, so smoothly it was strewn, and on the bay the moonlight lay, and the shadow of the moon. The rock shone bright, the kirk no less, that stands above the rock. The moonlight steeped in silentness the steady weathercock. And the bay was white with silent light, till rising from the same, full many shapes that shadows were, in crimson colors came. A little distance from the prow those crimson shadows were. I turned my eyes upon the deck. O Christ, what saw I there? Each course lay flat, lifeless and flat, and by the holy rood, a man all light, a seraph man, on every course there stood. This seraph band, each waved his hand, it was a heavenly sight. They stood as signals to the land, each one a lovely light. This seraph band, each waved his hand, no voice did they impart. No voice, but oh, the silence sank like music on my heart. But soon I heard the dash of oars, I heard the pilot's cheer. My head was turned perforce away, and I saw a boat appear. The pilot and the pilot's boy, I heard them coming fast. Dear Lord in heaven, it was a joy the dead men could not blast. I saw a third, I heard his voice. It is the hermit good. He singeth loud his godly hymns that he makes in the wood. He'll shrieve my soul, he'll wash away the albatross's blood. This hermit good lives in that wood which slopes down to the sea. How loudly his sweet voice he rears. He loves to talk with mariners that come from a far country. He kneels at morn and noon and eve. He hath a cushion plump. It is the moss that wholly hides the rotted old oak stump. The skiff boat neared. I heard them talk. Why is this strange, I trow? Where are those lights so many and fair that signal made but now?
Strange, by my faith, the hermit said, and they answered not our cheer. The planks looked warp, and see those sails, how thin they are and sere. I never saw aught like to them, unless perchance it were brown skeletons of leaves that lag my forest brook along. When the ivy tod is heavy with snow, and the owlet whoops to the wolf below that eats the she-wolf's young. "Dear Lord, it hath a fiendish look," the pilot made reply. "I am afeard. Push on, push on," said the hermit cheerily. The boat came closer to the ship, but I nor spake nor stirred. The boat came close beneath the ship, and straight a sound was heard. Under the water it rumbled on, still louder and more dread. It reached the ship, it split the bay, the ship went down like lead. Stunned by that loud and dreadful sound, which sky and ocean smote, like one that hath been 7 days drowned, my body lay afloat. But swift as dreams myself I found within the pilot's boat. Upon the whirl where sank the ship, the boat spun round and round, and all was still save that hill was telling of the sound. I moved my lips, the pilot shrieked, and fell down in a fit. The holy hermit raised his eyes and prayed where he did sit. I took the oars, the pilot's boy, who now doth crazy go, laughed loud and long, and all the while his eyes went to and fro. "Ha, ha, ha," quoth he, "full plain I see, the devil knows how to row." And now, all in my own country, I stood on the firm land. The hermit stepped forth from the boat, and scarcely he could stand. "Oh, shrieve me, holy man," the hermit crossed his brow. "Say quick," quoth he, "I bid thee say, what manner of man art thou?" Forthwith this frame of mine was wrenched with a woeful agony, which forced me to begin my tale, and then it left me free. Since then, at an uncertain hour, that agony returns, and till my ghastly tale is told, this heart within me burns. I pass like night from land to land. I have strange power of speech. That moment that his face I see, I know the man that must hear me. To him my tale I teach. What loud uproar bursts from that door? The wedding guests are there. But in the garden bower the bride and bridesmaids singing are, and hark the little vesper bell which biddeth me to prayer. O wedding guest, this soul hath been alone on a wide, wide sea, so lonely 'twas that God himself scarce seemed there to be. O sweeter than the marriage feast, 'tis sweeter far to me to walk together to the kirk with a goodly company. To walk together to the kirk and all together pray, while each to his great father bends, old men and babes and loving friends, and youths and maidens gay. Farewell, farewell, but this I tell to thee, thou wedding guest, he prayeth well who loveth well, both man and bird and beast. He prayeth best who loveth best all things both great and small, for the dear God who loveth us, he made and loveth all. The mariner whose eye is bright, whose beard with age is hoar, is gone, and now the wedding guest turned from the bridegroom's door. He went like one that hath been stunned, and is of sense forlorn. A sadder and a wiser man, he rose the morrow morn.
Okay, you made it through. One of you made it through, at least. I guess I could say one of us made it through. So let me tell you why this happened. And yeah, now the episode is going to be long. I finished editing the episode. I had decided it would be my next, and then the next episode would be the two-parters that were done. And that was foolish of me, because it means that there's like a three-week stretch with no episodes, when there didn't need to be. Boy, I'm dumb. But I was at the cabin. I had edited the episode. I knew that it was short, and I wanted to find a story that was in the public domain that I could include as a bonus. And I have this book that I take to the cabin with me, or it's always at the cabin, in case I run out of things to read or I just want some short stories. It's a big anthology of scary stories, and most of them are old. Most of them are public domain. There's stuff by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe. There was a story by Winston Churchill, and that was amazing to me. I remember reading somewhere that he had been a fiction writer before he went into politics, but I very nearly shared that story, except for I feel like it would work better with an English accent. But it had these stories in it, and one of them is Casting the Runes by M.R. James. And that is a story that I've meant to read many, many times and never been able to, because it always puts me to sleep. Always. In fact, there is a like YouTube video of a narrator reading Casting the Runes, and I turn it on about 3 or 4 nights a week when I'm needing to go to sleep, because it puts me out immediately. But there's this line in Casting the Runes where the guy goes, you know, it's like that old poem that goes,
like one that on a lonesome road doth walk in fear and dread, and having once turned round, walks on and no more turns his head, because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him tread.
I love that line. It's wonderful. So I was looking through the book for something shorter and something else that I might be able to share. And there were a couple of stories that I read through, and, you know, that weren't bad. That, you know, they weren't for me. There was one that was, it was super predictable. I mean, it was so, the ending is telegraphed at the very, very beginning. And it was so telegraphed that I thought, oh, there's going to be a twist. And it's not going to end the way that you think. Oh, it did end that way. Well, that's not cool. And so I didn't do that one. Finally, I went to the end of the book, and there was a John Wyndham story. I was reading it through, not aloud, but just reading it through to see if maybe this is a story that I would want to present to you guys. And it had the quote from Rime of the Ancient Mariner in it. You know, a fearsome fiend doth follow close behind. Also, and I just thought, this is too weird that two stories would quote that. I should do Rime of the Ancient Mariner, because I had never read it.
I had heard of it. There's this line in Serenity where Malcolm Reynolds makes reference to the poem, and then he says, yeah, you know, I've actually read a poem. Big deal, big shock.
Because the operative, I think, makes reference to an albatross around Mal's neck. So I got it, and I read it. And it's so long. It's the actual title, I think, is Rime of the Ancient Mariner, a poem in 7 parts. And like each part is as long as a regular poem. Plus, there's some archaic language. Plus, the meter fluctuates. Plus, oh gosh, there are different characters that are speaking during the poem. And this is not something that I realized until I was already recording it. And I was too tired. I couldn't. These are the things that I do for you, folks. Some interesting stuff, though, about the poem is that there are 3 or 4 things that are in the poem that we still quote today. I mean, obviously, an albatross around your neck comes from Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and, you know, people will still talk about that. And water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink, is something that people will still say. I mean, it's a misquote, but it comes from this. The fearsome fiend line is something that I wouldn't have guessed that people quote, but apparently they do. One thing that I read up about on the poem is that Coleridge, and I'm hoping I'm saying that right, it could be Coleridge, I guess, but the author of the poem rewrote it over and over again over the next 20-something years. And he would revise it, and because it was published when it was published, I want to say 1798, it was published like the year after he wrote it, but he would continually revise it, and it would be republished, and it would be recollected and reshared, and there were all of these different editions, different versions with different lines and things that were clarified or revised or added to. I mean, it reminds me of George Lucas and Star Wars, the Star Wars. Well, there were different versions of Star Wars even in 1977. But then, you know, it was re-released in 81, and suddenly it's called Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. There was a difference between the version that my buddies had recorded off of HBO and the version that I had that was off Fox Home Video. There was the special edition in 97. There was the DVD version, I think, which was in 2004. There was the Blu-ray edition with the blinking Ewoks. And yes, there was the Disney Plus edition with McClunky in it. Just amazing. But I guess, you know, it's not without precedent. I have recorded this, and I hope that at least one of you got something from it. Epic poetry is really, really hard for me to get my head around and to enjoy. When my brother was a senior, junior or senior in high school, they were assigned to read and, like, interpret Beowulf. He came to me, I was out of school by then, and he was like, dude, I can't make heads or tails of this. I don't know what any of this is. And so we went through it together, and I felt like, oh, you know, let me show you how it's done, young man. But by the time we got to the end of Beowulf, I was in the same boat as him. I was just like, oh, dude, why would a teacher assign this? Why? So that's it. I'm going to let you go, and I still have to edit the dang poem. So that means that we are without an episode again for a week at least. Feel free to support me on Patreon. If I don't say it in every single episode, it's because I hate to say it. But I really would like you guys to do so. I've lost another patron. He was nice enough to say, hey, look, this is why I'm dropping my support. It's not that I don't like you. It's not you. It's me. And I appreciated that, because sometimes people will just drop off and you don't know why. But I will be back again next episode with stuff that's already edited. Thanks. And try not to glance behind again, because you don't know what might be following. Good night.
The podcast you have just listened to was produced under a Creative Commons, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Share it while you still have the chance. And remember, there's a Patreon page out there if you'd like to throw a dollar or two my way. I must be dreaming.
About 200 episodes ago of the Rish Outcast, I ran my story. So a single word. I can't remember what it was called. What was that story called where the girl was died while texting and was buried with her cell phone? Subtext.